This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 2 million Native Americans living in the United States endured the highest poverty rate of any racial group in the country. Add to that high suicide rates, pervasive problems with alcohol and drugs, rape, and child abuse, all of which are more severe among the half of the population who live on reservations. And you have a painfully obvious crisis among North American Natives. What's less obvious are solutions. Some point to broken treaties that should be honored, others toward racial stereotypes in American culture that ought to be banned. But Naomi Schaefer Riley says what Native Americans need are property rights. She's author of The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians, and wrote about property rights on reservations for The Atlantic. Naomi, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So if you could summarize the laws that govern property on Native American reservations here in the U.S., what's the sort of status quo?
Right. So I think a lot of people don't really understand what a reservation is. A reservation means that the land is held in trust by the federal government. The only other people, by the way, that we hold things legally in trust for are children or the mentally incompetent. So I think it's actually pretty shameful that in the 21st century, this is the way we're talking about Indian lands. But what that means, in effect, is that if one Indian wanted to sell land on a reservation to another one, they would first have to get the permission of a bureaucrat from the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington. But the problems actually go much beyond that. If you wanted to, as an American Indian, get a mortgage on a reservation and you went to a bank, they would not give you one because you don't have the underlying title to the land. They would have no collateral, and they would not be able to foreclose on the property if you did not pay. In addition to that, of course, many Americans use the capital that they get from their land in order to start small businesses. They take out second mortgages or home equity loans, and American Indians don't have that access to capital that the rest of us have.
So everyday Americans enjoy these rights withheld from Native Americans. Why? What or who governs these rights? Is it old treaties?
No, it's actually it's the reservation system that was set up. And unfortunately, I think what people have failed to understand is while the reservation system was really set up as a way of pushing Indians out of the way and keeping sort of them in a controlled space while we pursued manifest destiny, now I think people have come to see reservations as almost a way of protecting Indians, as a way of ensuring that white people don't get their land, buy their land, or take their land from them. And we've kind of set it up as this idea that Indians on these reservations are living in some kind of, you know, socialist, environmentalist utopia that is kind of frozen in time. But during the interviews that I did across the country on different reservations, I found that, of course, this is not the way Indians want to live. They want the same freedoms the rest of us have.
Is that universal? I mean, I'm imagining that normalizing property rights could have a huge economic impact, but it would also remove the protections of setting aside land. You know, if land could be sold to non-natives, isn't there a risk of these areas being lost to tribes?
I think that, of course, one of the things you could do is you could sort of set aside these lands and say they will still be governed by the tribes. In the same way that if you, you know, had the city of Boston, one person sells land to somebody else in the city of Boston, it's still part of the city of Boston. It's just that individual owns it differently. And it's part of a system of property rights that is enforced by the government. But the problem is that this system really assumes that what Indians want is maybe to be farmers. I mean, a lot of the pieces, tracts of land that are owned are even too small to do anything useful with. So if you're an American Indian and you want to start up, you want to start a store, or you want to pursue a career, you know, that might require you to have money to put toward education, you don't have access for any of these things. And the result on the reservations is that there's almost no private sector. I visited one Indian reservation in Montana where the unemployment rate is 78%. A lot of people say, "Oh, you mean the employment rate?" No, no, no. I mean the unemployment rate. There are really no there's no private enterprise. All of the employment is done by the federal government or the tribal government, and people really can't pursue the things that they want to as individuals or as families.
Okay, so you mentioned the no right to buy, sell, have a mortgage. How about development projects? You just mentioned the Crow Reservation in Montana you visited, and there is government funding there for building a new veterans home. And of course, casinos have changed the economy for many tribes.
So, right, there is government funding for projects, and it just takes years and years and years for anything to get done because of the vast bureaucracy. I visited what was going to be a 15-bed veterans home that was going to cost $15 million. I mean, this is how much money it has taken to get through all of the different bureaucracies. There are 9,000 staff members at the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's one for approximately every 110 American Indians on a reservation. And the American Indians themselves, you know, they refer to the BIA as bossing Indians around. They would really like Washington's bureaucracy off their backs. In terms of development, of course, Indian lands, while maybe in the 19th century were thought of sometimes as useless because they didn't have the proper soil for farming or raising cattle, a lot of them are hugely valuable now because they're sitting on top of coal or oil or resources that could be used for fracking if they wanted to. But the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Environmental Protection Agency combined to make it much more difficult for Indians to develop their land than for white people to develop theirs just a few steps off the reservation. One of the legislators I talked to said, "We are the most overregulated race on earth."
I'm speaking with Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's written a book called The New Trail of Tears, and it's about how Washington policy affects and governs American Indians. We're speaking specifically about U.S. law, which holds property rights in trust for Native Americans, and she says it's contributing to the grinding poverty among Native people. So the Indians that you spoke to, what do they envision? Tourism, mining, how would they do it differently?
Well, I think that they would do different things. I mean, different tribes would do different things, and different individual Indians would do different things. You have to come to understand that there's regulation both on what the tribes can do with public lands, but also what individuals could do with their lands. So I spoke to one man who was trying to buy a small piece of land from one of his neighbors to graze a few cattle on, and he and his neighbor had agreed on a price. And someone from the Bureau of Indian Affairs came in and said, "No, you can't sell it for that price because that's not fair market value." Now, of course, fair market value is, of course, what someone will give you for the land. It's not an artificial number that Washington comes up with. So those are sort of the two things. But to get back to your question, you mentioned casinos earlier. So those are tribal enterprises. And, you know, we do have to keep in mind that the number of actually successful casinos that have produced significant revenue is relatively small. I mean, we see them in the Northeast, you know, places like Connecticut. But most of the casinos that are in existence are really these kind of small, dinky affairs where there's no tourism. And so the only people who are actually at the casinos are reservation Indians themselves. So it's in that sense, it's not doing those tribes much good. But it's also actually had extremely harmful effects on some of the tribes that have even been successful. So I visited the Seneca Territory in upstate New York. Now, they've actually made $1 billion on their gaming revenues, both on their territory and at a casino in Buffalo as well. Unfortunately, the way that money gets distributed is in annuities. So when you turn 21 on the Seneca Reservation, on the Seneca Territory, someone sends you a check for more than $30,000. Now, up until that point, you've had a pretty dismal education because the schools that exist on the territory and just off the territory are pretty terrible. You may not have worked at all because the unemployment rate is so high. You've never saved or invested, and you have no idea what to do with this money. And many tribal officials acknowledge that a lot of it just gets spent on drugs and alcohol, sadly.
You just mentioned the school's inadequate education. Yet, looking at what you wrote about, $20,000 spent per pupil. Now, that's compared to a national average of $12,400. A lot of money, billions of dollars going into managing, subsidizing lives, subsidizing housing, subsidizing other economic developments, road maintenance, courts, agriculture, social services, health for Native American people here in the U.S. Why isn't it working?
Well, I think there are a number of different reasons. First of all, as I mentioned, you have just the vast bureaucracy that has overtaken this, and bureaucrats will always find something to do. They don't want to lose their jobs. And so one of the things that certainly happens is a lot of the money just ends up staying in Washington. The second problem is corruption. It's not true on every reservation, but certainly a lot of tribes suffer from this problem, and the money does not necessarily get to the people who need it. But then you just have the problem of government distribution of wealth. Like I said, there is no private sector. And so one of the results of that is that there is just an extraordinary amount of nepotism on these reservations. If you have a relative, an uncle, a cousin, perhaps, who's on the tribal council and you want to be the fourth grade teacher, it doesn't matter whether you're qualified or not. You have the connection, and you could be the fourth grade teacher. It similarly works the other way. If you, happen to have a student who is related to someone powerful in the tribe, and that student hasn't shown up to, 6 months worth of eighth grade, that eighth grade teacher, and I've interviewed some of these people, will be forced sometimes to pass that child, even if they're totally unqualified to go to the next grade, simply because of that family connection. So you can see how it is kind of, no matter how much money you pour into the system, if you've undermined the quality controls that are there, then there's really no way of ensuring success. I mean, American Indians have a 50% high school graduation rate, and that number is even lower for American Indians who just live on the reservation. Mm.
It just sounds like dismal conditions here in the U.S. And in Canada, there has been a push for legislation called the First Nations Property Ownership Act. Now, this would give them the legal framework for individual members to access capital, land rights. It's been described as, taking the feds out of the equation. What chance does the legislation have of passing?
Well, I think it actually has a pretty good chance. Right now, it's been a little bit sidetracked by some other Canadian Supreme Court decisions on Native and land rights. But I think there's actually widespread support for it. And one of the advantages that the legislation has is that tribes could opt in or out of it. If they don't want these property rights and they feel that this might, cause them some kind of, overturning of traditions in some ways, they don't have to take advantage of it. But for the tribes, particularly those in British Columbia, which have a great deal of political power in Canada, they are really trying to figure out ways that they can offer, get their people the kinds of freedoms that other people have. I visited, the Kamloops Band, and it's such an interesting contrast. You have on two sides of the river. One is regular Canadian British Columbia land, and the other land is what's called reserve land. That's what they call reservations there. Mm-hmm. And on the reserve land, you see great poverty, but you also see a lot of what's revealing about the property rights problem. There are temporary structures that are there. A lot of the land that is most valuable is simply being occupied by trailer homes. It's very hard when you don't have property rights to put any long-term investment into an area.
How would you compare Canada's laws and the motivation of Native Americans here in the U.S.?
I think they have a greater amount of political power simply because of the way natives are distributed there, which is to say that in certain provinces, they're actually carrying quite a bit of political power because of their numbers. In America, you have a few states, places like South Dakota or Arizona, where there's a significant Native population, but those states are, of course, a couple among the 50 states. And so I think that balance of power, the power structure that you see in Canada is not the same as here. And they also have very different, they have different treaties and different Supreme Court laws about this. But, as odd as it seems and as perhaps offensive as it seems to some people, I think that we can all agree that the system we have in place is simply not working today. And it's really time to rethink the way we have tried to protect the rights of Indians, because what we're doing is not working.
Naomi, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's author of a book called The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians. And she wrote about property rights on reservations for The Atlantic. You'll find a link to both at wordofmouthradio.org.